Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast, a Book of the Week format podcast which represents a long, thick thorn in the side of literature itself, emanating an endless need to analyze and bring meaning. Today we're talking about Annihilation, which is the first book in Jeff Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy. This is going to be the first of three episodes in which we'll be discussing that trilogy. And the Southern Reach trilogy tells the story of Area X, which is a section of the United States that's been cordoned off by the government due to being transformed through some kind of uncertain method into a place of surreal danger and chaos. So Annihilation, the first book of that trilogy, tells of the 12th expedition to visit Area X, which is composed of four women. Our first-person narrator, who's a biologist, a psychologist who commands the expedition, a surveyor, and an anthropologist. So here's basically a high-level overview of the main events in the novel. The team enters Area X, discovers a tunnel leading down into the ground, which the biologist compulsively and inexplicably thinks of as a tower. In the tower is a strange Old Testament-ish run-on sentence written in living organisms. The biologist inhales a spore from that organism. They return to the surface, and then during the night, the psychologist uses hypnotic commands to force the surveyor to return to the tunnel to try to take a sample of the organism, which is writing the words on the wall. That organism kills the surveyor, although that sequence of events is reconstructed after the fact by the biologist. The biologist continues to journey further into Area X. She finds a lighthouse, which is kind of the main landmark of that region. Inside that lighthouse, she finds an enormous mound of journals and records, suggestive of many more than 12 expeditions. She also finds a photograph of a lighthouse keeper. Outside of the lighthouse, she finds the psychologist, who has jumped from the top of the lighthouse, is barely being kept alive by some kind of mystical force. The biologist has then a violent confrontation with the surveyor. She only survives that because of a sort of sensation of brightness inside her that is enhancing her senses and her awareness, that brightness being presumably the result of inhaling the spores. She travels back into the tunnel, has an encounter with the creature writing those words. That creature probes her mind and lets her go. She recognizes the lighthouse keeper somewhere inside it. Interspersed with the narration of the expedition, we also have the biologist's recollections of her career, which involved the study of ecosystems such as an overgrown swimming pool or a tide pool or a vacant lot. That study is so obsessive that it cripples her relationship to her husband. It keeps her from performing adequate field work as a biologist. And her husband had been on the previous expedition. She finds his journal. She reads it. It is addressed to her. And she realizes that her husband had an inner life that she did not really make an adequate effort to explore. She resolves to travel further into Area X to perhaps find him, perhaps find some more record of him or connect with him somehow. So am I leaving out anything significant from that summary, first of all? Anything you guys would add to that that is going to be helpful for understanding the text?
Don't forget the doppelgangers. Something creates the doppelgangers, and that's presumably what she sleeps with when she thinks her husband comes home.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Her husband in particular, prior, in between the 11th and 12th expeditions, her husband has come home, but he has kind of a vacant quality, seems to only half understand or recognize anything, dies of cancer, and then, you know, she figures out that that was likely a doppelganger. So I'm Hans Berger. I am one of the three regular co-hosts of Book Spider. I'm here with Chris Malmberg.
Hello.
And Patrick Barney, who I think wanted to share a quick bit of news before we move on.
Yeah, that's me. I'm Patrick. I just wanted to remind everyone that my disturbing but hilarious horror novel, Gusano, is available now. So check it out. It's about a really bad dude who can turn people into worms, and crazy hijinks ensue. The only issue is you cannot find it in the usual method of Googling someone's name and a title. Unfortunately, the only real way I have found to locate the book online is to go to Google, type in Anxiety Press, which is the press that publishes the novel. One of the results should be a link to their Amazon page. Click that link. Then you got to click on their books, one of which is mine, Gusano Patrick Barney, Gusano. Thank you, Hans and Chris, for letting me plug my novel one more time.
All right. So returning to the subject of Annihilation, I just for a little bit of background, I guess, I read this trilogy, probably 3 or 4 years ago now, probably like late 2019, I read this trilogy. I really enjoyed the movie, which I think we're going to come around to probably later on in this podcast, but I read the trilogy and found myself somewhat confused and underwhelmed by it, right? And, you know, one thing that I say a lot on the podcast is that I often really enjoy books where I kind of come out the other end feeling like I got some of what was there, but definitely not all of it. And for some reason, with this trilogy, I came out the other end feeling that same sensation and being kind of dissatisfied and let down by it. So, but I think it's possible that I was reading it too quickly or without enough attention, or maybe kind of underestimating the complexity of what it was trying to do. So I wanted to go through that series again, in a slower, more thoughtful way with a couple of thoughtful guys to kind of help, thoughtful people who happen to be guys, I suppose, to help bounce some of the observations and ideas off of, to maybe kind of sound the depths of it out in a more enlightening way. And when I was getting ready to do this podcast, I have a friend who's fond of this trilogy and was, in fact, the first person to recommend it to me even before the movie came out. And I asked him the other night, what are they about, right? Like, what theme or idea should I keep in mind while rereading these to help unlock them? What's the point here, right? And his answer was there are some things we'll never understand, meaning that, as you know, his summary of the theme, not a statement about the futility of understanding these books. And I found that answer so unsatisfying that I kind of regretted asking. But, you know, at least based on the first book, how do you guys feel about that as a thematic statement?
It's not what I would take from this.
What would you take?
I think I have a couple inchoate ideas. One of which is probably, like, I would say, it seems similar to Solaris.
That's a good comparison.
In that we've got this, like, possibly alien intelligence, though we don't know if it's an intelligence and we're not sure if it's alive. At least not in the case of Annihilation, like, we're not necessarily sure there's a central intelligence at play. But, you know, like, as the Southern Reach, the shadowy organization known as the Southern Reach, sends various teams inside of Area X, it seems like basically they're trying to do experiments to understand it. And at the same time, the Area X itself seems to be experimenting with the environment, including the people that come into it, to maybe understand them. And so it seems like there's two possible intelligences, Area X and Southern Reach, kind of trying to understand one another and totally misunderstanding one another. That is one possibility that I see, which I think is interesting. Like, I think Solaris is a great novel. I really enjoy it. I think it's an interesting exploration of the limits of our ability to understand other things.
We've talked about Solaris on this podcast, haven't we?
We didn't do the book, but I think we talked about it when we talked about Roadside Picnic.
Yeah, Roadside Picnic and Sphere, I think, didn't we?
So that's one like idea that I get out of this book. But after having watched the movie a second time and liking it a little bit more, like, I wouldn't say that I found it any more emotionally enjoyable the second time around, but the thematic statement of the film made more sense to me the second time around. And the thematic statement of the film to me is this idea is Area X is a metaphor for Lena, the biologist character in the movie. It's a metaphor for her own self-destructive tendencies, right? Like, just as life has a tendency, like Area X, has a tendency to create and destroy in ways that are both beautiful and ugly and in ways that make sense and that don't. Just as Area X does this, Lena does it too. Like, you could read the movie as, like, kind of every horrible thing that happens is her fault. You could read, you know, her husband, spoiler alert, her actual husband blowing himself up with a Frosters grenade. You know, maybe he goes to Area X because he finds out she's having an affair, and then his mind goes and he blows himself up because he doesn't know who he is, which is all brought about by her affair. And then, you know, there are other ways to kind of read that idea of self-destruction in the movie. Now, what I want to say here is that we could also read that theme into the novel. I think the novel could support that with maybe the addition that the novel is a little more hopeful or optimistic about the possibility of saving oneself from self-destruction, something like that. Since in the novel, the biologist and her husband's probably dead, but he could potentially be alive. And it seems like the biologist does do something to be able to live within the environment, unlike her colleagues. So that's another thought that comes to me.
Because he brought up the movie. You know, I think that it's a useful sort of reference point for talking about the book, because the book is pretty, I don't think the word prism appears in the book. It appears in the movie, though. But the book is super prismatic. Like, it even though most of the details of the book are pretty concrete and the narrator is very controlled. Basically, you get the sense that emotionally, like, centered, almost kind of a distance from herself that maybe even unnerves the people around her a little bit. Like, she is observant, internal, and for that reason, and because of the mysterious nature of Area X and what's actually happening around her, it feels like the book is gesturing in the direction of potentially, you know, many different themes without necessarily resolving them. I actually find the movie to be a little bit more pointed, maybe.
Mm, yeah.
It has a trajectory to its thematic, And then the book is almost more like something static that you can shine light through in different directions and see a lot of different things.
Mm. Interesting.
And I think, like, you know, one thing that I don't, you know, I too am sort of unsatisfied by, like, explaining the draw of the book as, you know, there are things that we will never understand. That's not that interesting, but it does feel to me like the narrator being a biologist, and I think this is somewhat present in both the movie and the book, it feels like there's a distinction drawn between seeking to understand and belonging to. And it feels like the thing that Area X robs of the people who enter it is the ability to understand, and then they have no choice but to belong to it, right? Whether it kills them, remakes them, you know, unmakes them, mutates them. Basically, everyone who enters Area X belongs to it, which is an interesting transition for someone who, as a biologist, has a kind of a fascination with, you know, that borders on intimate with the, you know, like, I think she talks about a pool in her childhood backyard that is overgrown, and her fascination with it is profound. But, you know, there's this scientific distance as well, and she has a kind of a coldness to her that I think threatens to make her kind of a bland viewpoint character. She's a little bit, I don't know, there is a kind of a coldness to her. Maybe that's the wrong word. And then I think that coldness is something that, like, she comes to regret toward her husband, that distance, and that transition to, you know, kind of actually, like, belonging to Area X feels like it's a little bit of a transition to wanting to belong to this relationship that she now looks back on with fondness and some regret.
I wonder if maybe, like, the the character arc, or kind of the direction of the character focus in the movie and the book, isn't inverted in a way.
I feel like it is.
In the movie, I mean, you talked, Patrick, about self-destruction and the idea of her being self-destructive, and the movie does literally end with her, you know, burning her doppelganger with a phosphorus grenade, if I remember
correctly. Right, yeah.
And so, I mean, it's the most obvious, literal, possible externalization of the idea of self-destruction and of the idea of self-examination and looking at truly coming to understand or see the self, right? I mean, like, the whole final sequence is her kind of mirrored by this doppelganger that becomes more and more like her literal self as it develops. And the book is, I think, much more about coming out of solitude or coming out of isolation. You know, it made me think a little bit about the parallels between the scientist and the artist, right? Like, as someone who's been some form of artist for my whole adult life, I've struggled constantly with the ways in which absorption in art, either as a creator or a consumer, have, for the most part, isolated me from many of the people around me and led to a great deal of solitude. And her interest in nature, her kind of the purest form of her work that kind of has this shell of, you know, professional biology put on over it, like, that is a very isolating thing. And so the arc in the book is much more about, I mean, among other things, I guess, learning to see the kind of depth of the inner life of her husband that she didn't previously appreciate. So they're going in, the examination and the attention are going in opposite directions. And that may actually be one thing that makes the book more appealing, actually, because there is, you know, like you've already mentioned, a warmth and an optimism to that, that is, it's gratifying, particularly coming from a character who has been so detached and cold throughout the most of the action of the book.
I definitely would say that's why I enjoyed the book more than I did the movie. As I said, I watched it a second time for the podcast, and like got into the themes, like really wrapped my head around the themes, and so enjoyed it on an intellectual level. But I definitely find the arc of the character in the book much more satisfying. You know, even if I am a pessimist by nature, maybe not by nature, but a pessimist by intellectual commitment, I'm probably, you know, an optimist by nature. Meaning, you know, I kind of prefer to hope that human beings can get out of their self-destructive tendencies or evolve beyond the things that make them do bad things. Whereas the movie is, the thing about the movie is, like, we do get to see this interesting, like, how, well, it's like her self, the Nicole, not Nicole, Natalie Portman character in the book, it doesn't really seem like she is the one who comes to understand her self-destruction so much as the audience, like, sees, oh, it's been revealed, she is kind of this self-destructive force, whereas she doesn't ever come to a reckoning with that. And so on that level, I find the movie less enjoyable.
I wonder if it's relevant in the movie that Area X comes to an understanding of that. The ending is so ambiguous that it's hard to say, but sure, I wonder if it's meaningful that in the way that the audience learns that, like the kind of whatever unifying consciousness there is to Area X comes to understand that as well.
Yeah. Hmm.
Because Area X internalizes the self-destructive nature that, you know, Natalie Portman exhibits and basically refracts that across, you know, itself and then seems to fall apart. And I'll say, like, I actually find the movie hopeful because
you're dumb.
Because I'm dumb.
I'm sorry. I always feel like that everybody's going to crack up when I make these stupid jokes and nobody does. Sorry about that.
No, it's all right. It's fine. I'm just crying on the inside. I think for me, the thematic thing that is interesting about Annihilation, and I think this has come up maybe in a couple of other things we've talked about, like, you can belong to something or you can seek to understand it, and you can't actually do both, right? Like you can, it's like, trying to, breathe while thinking about breathing, or dance while thinking about dancing, or something like that. There's some hokey, you know, saccharine analogy that'll work for that. But I think, it's an interesting to me to think about that with the book, and it's enough, it's chewy enough that I can kind of think about it for a while. With the movie, I think that the Area X is far more, you know, ambiguous. It's like a prion disease or a process. Like, it's like a thing that is just sort of perpetuating patterns, and it may be mindful, it may be mindless, it might be entirely indifferent to our presence. And to me, like, the ending, when basically she and her husband are reunited, it feels like the whole movie could be read as a kind of perspective on what it means to survive a really terrible shock to your marriage, and to come out the other side and not be the same person and not be married to the same person, but to actually choose to continue anyway, you know, like, and I actually found that to be kind of hopeful. And I find both, even though they're both, you know, pretty dark, I actually find both of them somewhat optimistic if you're considering how dark things could be walking into something like Area X. But
I don't want to like keep necessarily talking about the movie since we're here to talk about the book. But
it's fine. I like the movie a lot, and I think if it's helping us illuminate the book, then that's fine, particularly because we are going to have two more episodes on the books, right? There's only one movie. There's three books. So I'm quite happy to indulge this as much as we want to.
All I was going to say is that the ending of the movie definitely did not, like, where we're talking about that final scene where the doppelganger of Natalie Portman's husband hugs her, and then you see both of their eyes glowing. That, to me, didn't seem hopeful, like these people were going to survive and pursue their relationship only changed. To me, it seemed like the self-destructive tendencies that are evident in Area X and in Natalie Portman's character are going to continue. That's kind of the way I took it. I like no shade on the way you're looking at it, Chris.
Better not. Keep that shade to yourself.
Just sure. Just comparing our reactions.
I want to come back a little bit to some of the comparisons that you made to Solaris, right? And I think it's interesting to think about. We talked a little bit about the idea of the book being about things that you don't understand, and just the statement on its own that there are things that you'll never understand perhaps is not satisfying. But I wonder if the appeal of the inexplicable is part of what's, and this is, I don't know if we can tie this back to what we said about relationships and character arcs here, but I wonder if part of what's appealing is the idea of the appeal of things that are inexplicable. And in particular, I'm thinking about the relationship that is drawn between the what's called the crawler, the kind of mutated lighthouse keeper-ish blob that is writing the living words. The parallel between that and an experience that the biologist talks about where she sees a starfish called a destroyer of worlds. And the ways in which what is, in both, I think that like Area X, in spite of being initially presented as a kind of perversion of nature or a warping of nature, can also be understood as something that kind of replicates the inexplicable awe that we feel in encountering certain aspects of nature, right? The kind of, particularly if you're someone who doesn't have, if you're someone who has a deep enough scientific background to really kind of understand what's happening in nature, it can also be, at least I think the book would say, inexplicable and confusing and awe-inspiring and horrifying. And, you know, like Area X, in a way, is it is an unknowable thing. It's a mysterious thing. It's a horrifying thing, but in ways which are perhaps a version of how we encounter or think about nature. And, you know, what you said about the comparison to Solaris, right? Solaris, I think you had put forward the idea that, you know, this is about, this and Solaris are both about kind of two radically different intelligences trying to understand each other in ways which are ultimately maybe unproductive, right? That it's about kind of a mutual probing for understanding between radically different organisms. And I think that's interesting both. First of all, I think that's like I agree with the parallel of that. The sharpness of that is very good. I think it's also, in a way, you know, some of what we've been talking about with character relationships and the ways that people are either alienated from themselves or alienated from each other it mirrors that a little bit too, right? It's kind of like a large scale version both of the inexplicability of nature and the inexplicability of other people, in both versions, really. I mean, I think in Solaris, you know, the planet is unknowable, but in some ways that's kind of a way of externalizing the mystery and unknowability of the dead girlfriend character,
right?
For instance,
right. In the book, Hari. In the movies, some other name that doesn't sound like Harry in English.
I don't know if I have any way to turn that into a question, but
yeah, I definitely think it's like in the book. I think there's good if we make the comparison to Solaris, we can internally make the comparison between Southern Reach and Area X trying to like probe one another for info. We can parallel that with the non-understanding between the biologist and her husband, right? In the same kind of way. So there are definitely like resonances, you know, there are definitely things that vibrate at the same frequency in the novel.
It's interesting too. I was trying to think about like the moments of, like, so much of the book is about moments of misunderstanding and disconnection. There's the kind of the opposite of that, of course, is the way that, in terms of personal relationships, the way that the biologist comes to understand her husband's inner life. But in terms of the relationship to Area X, there's the moment when the biologist feels herself being probed by the organism that she's called the Crawler. And in the run-up to what kills a different person, but the Crawler, in some sense, to the best of her understanding, sees something in her that causes it to let her go, right? So there's also a moment of mutual understanding and sympathy there, even though it's mutual understanding that is at the same time totally inexplicable, which is an interesting idea, I suppose. Like, there must be a recognition of empathy or kinship there, but at the same time, it remains inexplicable, at least to the biologist, and in some ways maybe even to the Crawler as well, right? Because who knows what kind of conscious or unconscious ways it acts. Do you guys have any sense from reading the book of why it is that the Crawler lets her go?
I thought it was just the spores and what they were doing to her, and that she already had been changed enough in some ways to belong to this ecology, to this biome, or to this space. But maybe that was me kind of jumping to an easy conclusion.
It seems reasonable to me. I'm not sure myself. Like, certainly the idea that Area X has changed her, that she has incorporated it in some way, and maybe that makes a lot of sense if we assume that the reason she sees the face of the lighthouse keeper within the whorl or blob of the Crawler, maybe it takes pity on her or empathizes with her because it's in the same position. The lighthouse keeper has been incorporated into the entity, and that, like, maybe the entity fused with the lighthouse keeper sees that happening to the biologist as well, and like notices that kinship. So that's probably why. That's why.
I like that.
Yeah, I'm a genius. Sorry,
we should change the title of the podcast. Reasons why Patrick is a genius. Every episode is just a series of examples of why of Patrick's.
Do I say that? I say that every time, don't I? Jesus, I need to like calm down. My boss. My boss at work tells me, like, I need to calm down about myself. Like, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm all right.
Your boss at your job is a male?
Yeah. Like, I'll come in the morning and, you know, I try to be cheery and chipper, joking around with other people there, you know, calling each other pieces of shit and stuff, or, like, tell old 60-year-old men who've been mailmen for years and years and years that they look good or they're doing a good job, stuff like that. And, you know, I'll come back from my route or whatever, and I'll be like, yeah, man, I was great out there. I just delivered, stayed in 8 hours, no problems. I'm the best carrier. And, you know, then my boss will say, you know, you need to check yourself, Patrick.
Are there, you're touching now on the theme of language, right? The power of language, the ways that we use language to construct realities for ourselves, to kind of project things into the world that might be total bullshit. And that makes me wonder, are there any thoughts in the novel about the meaning or use of language? I mean, there's kind of this image of language that's very vivid, but I don't know if it's, I wasn't able to get much of a sense of thematic resonance out of it, even though it's such a key to the kind of image world of the novel.
I'm not sure, but it doesn't, the biologist say that the group comes to regret the fact that the linguist backed out before the linguist even came? Isn't that?
Yeah, she wishes the linguist was there to examine the words, right?
Like, right.
So they're all STEM folks, other than, I don't know if you'd consider a psychologist STEM, but like they're very hard sciences.
Linguistics is a freaking science, definitely. A softer science, like psychology.
Yeah, I think that the point is that they don't, you know, they're not.
There are no non-hard scientists.
Yeah, who studied language would be able to surmise something from the language itself. And I actually think that, like, I don't know, this is a bit of the prismatic nature of the book, but I think that the words seem purposefully evocative without actually meaning much at all. Like, in the way that, like, it feels...
Like, in a bad way, like the author fucked up? Or it's part of the crawler's personality to use language in a evocative but meaningless way?
Well, I think that, like, language, we have talked at various times in this podcast about where language breaks down in what, like,
never.
Situations. And it seems like, you know, something that occurred, another comparison that occurred to me, and it's funny you pointed out Solaris, because I think the most obvious one is, you know, the other Tarkovsky movie, Stalker, and, you know, which is based on Roadside Picnic. And I'd actually say Stalker much more than Roadside Picnic, just because of the kind of mysterious nature of the movie relative to the, you know, more, the book's not, it's mysterious, but it's just very different. But I also thought of Flatland or Flatlanders. I don't know if it's called Flatland or Flatlanders, but it's
Flatliners, where they try to kill themselves to get high.
No, not Flatlanders. Flatlanders is a book. I think it was written like at the early 1900s. It's pretty old. I'd never read it, but I've
the two-dimensional world.
Yeah, the two-dimensional world, like a triangle is wandering around, and at some point they encounter a sphere, and the sphere passes through their plane, and they lack the means, because it starts out as a point and then expands into a circle, and then the circle stops expanding, and then it starts to decrease in size, and it becomes a point again, and then it disappears. And basically it feels like that encounter with a higher dimension is a little bit representative of, and the difficulty in using existing language to describe it, or using language to describe an epiphany. You know, language, you know, bursts at the seams of trying to contain things that, like, are outside of our normal human experience. And it feels as though, I don't know if this is intended this way, but it feels as though the words, you know, carry a lot of, they feel mythologically huge, you know, like you said, the kind of like Old Testament sounding passage, but the actual meaning of them and their function in the story, it doesn't really amount to much. And I think that's part of this thing where, like, we look at the words as carrying the meaning, but actually the medium, the living fungal mass that's drawn on the wall and used to create the words has much more meaning than the words themselves. And I don't think it's meant to be that simple necessarily, but that's what comes to mind, that, like, the words are our kind of rational, like, attempts to abstract this bizarre experience into, you know, transcendental shapes that we can sort of, like, measure and quantify and understand, is not something that is meaningful in this space, you know, with what's going on. And, you know, I think the linguist not coming is that also feels like a, just sort of like craft wise, such a bizarre thing to do, like to have a character that we never meet just not show up. Like, why do you introduce that character not to bring them or talk about them ever again? It's just such an interesting thing to do. And it feels like there's something intentional about that, about how we're supposed to understand the words. And maybe it is to just sort of set aside their actual meaning as words, you know, like as language, and actually from the biologist's perspective to think about them more, you know, for what they're made of.
It's a way of emphasizing the red herring quality of that. It's a way of emphasizing the misdirection aspect of it, to really say, like, oh, we could have understood this if we'd had that linguist, but by emphasizing that, to actually then kind of drive home the idea that the content of them, as you, I think, very articulately put it, that the medium is actually more important than the content.
Yeah, I just don't know why craft-wise you'd have the linguist character in there otherwise. You know, like you'd say, well, just, I thought there was a linguist, and so but there isn't, so I'm going to cut out this idea that there was ever a linguist. That'd be easier to do than what he eventually does. But sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that I don't know if this is a particularly helpful thought in relationship to understanding the book, but what it kind of made me think of, actually, was, and I know everything kind of comes back to this lately, but it made me, the idea of this sentence that is this infinite scroll of words that is, on a surface level, appears to contain meaning, but does in fact probably not contain any conscious meaning inputted by the entity creating it, right? What's that remind you of?
Nothing.
Oh, I thought you guys would come up with it. ChatGPT.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Like an infinite scroll of meaningless words created by an entity that does not understand the words it's creating, in a context where the fact of something making language that you would not expect to make language is probably more resonant than anything really that's actually being quote-unquote said, right? And I mean, that probably doesn't crack the meaning of the novel itself open to us to any greater extent. I think it does, though, lend an extra level of kind of maybe eerie resonance with contemporary experience. And it's, you know, there's a certain prescience on the part of Vandermeer to put that in, probably accidental prescience, but still, it's an interesting, it's kind of acquired this interesting resonant layer now that it didn't have, you know, 15 years ago, however long ago when he wrote the book.
Wasn't it 2014?
10 years ago, I think. Yeah, 10 years ago.
That's, I mean, there's something that makes me think of, and it's, it doesn't have to do with the book, but it makes me think of language in a way that I hadn't before, which is that it is a, what would you call it? So the crawler is a chimera, you know, it's something that is, and it may be not even a chimera in the sense that like, it's an amalgamation or an, it's not, it, you know, it's, I don't know that we know whether it's an agglutination of things that preexisted or whether it's a bunch, it's an image, you know, fragmented images of those things kind of like crammed together. And in that way, it doesn't have like, you know, I can't say this for sure, but like, it has a plural, it's pluralistic of in viewpoint potentially. And the reason that I say that is I think of ChatGPT as a kind of a chimera made of, you know, countless facets, snapshots of language as employed. But the actual ChatGPT doesn't have a viewpoint. It's not an actor. And so it struck me that like language is a phenomena of singular, of being locked into a singular perspective. You know, like that's like the necessary environment for language to manifest. Otherwise it has no function. You know, like if you're part of a larger system and you belong to that larger system, and like the overlap between you and that system is blurred in a way that like, you know, is hard to describe right now, but I guess like, you know, you're part of the, you know, ecosystem, say, of something, then you don't necessarily need language to navigate it. But if you're isolated from it and isolated from others of your kind, you develop language to span those gaps. And I don't know, if just sort of thinking out loud, it just strikes me as like a fundamental challenge for any AI to replicate language is that like you're trying to force language on something that doesn't need it. You know, like it doesn't actually need language because it's not a singular viewpoint phenomenon. It doesn't have personhood or selfhood that is isolated from its context. And
are you sure? Panpsychism, baby. Panpsychism.
Oh, I like panpsychism. I think that that's a fascinating subject, but like, but I you know, it, whatever, like we're playing Calvin ball with theory right here, but like how you said that, Hans, I hadn't thought about language in that way before, that like, I just hadn't thought about it in that way before. So,
well, I had one other question on the list that I sent to you guys, which had to do with the role of authority, the way that the kind of concept of authority is portrayed here. But given that the, you know, in 2 weeks, we'll be talking about the next book in the series, which is literally called Authority. I had thought about having that in this episode as a primer, but I think actually it would be better to just fully defer that topic to 2 weeks from now. So in 2 weeks, we will be talking about excellent. Well, in 2 weeks, we'll be talking about the second book in the series, Authority. And at that point, we will touch perhaps back also on how that theme is reflected in this first book. Do you guys have any closing thoughts before we go, other than do what you have to find Gusano Gusano on Amazon by Patrick.
Yeah. Do what you got to. You don't want to miss it. Like, you will literally regret it.
Isn't it? I thought it was pronounced when, Gus Anal. You know.
Where's the AL? Where's the AL? Oh, man. No, Gusano. But, you know, if while you're reading it, you want to think of it as Gus Anal, okay.
Gus Anal is something, doesn't it? It has legs.
I guess.
Okay, well, on that note.
All right. Sorry. Nice talking to you guys.
Good talking to you, gentlemen.
Peace out, guys.